We're reporting this week on ways to help people stay in their homes as they grow older. You've seen that lady in the television commercial with the panic button around her neck?
I've fallen, and I can't get up!
We're sending help immediately, Mrs. Fletcher.
Well, high-tech monitoring has come a long way. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, there is a growing market in technology that lets adult children keep an eye on their parents 24 hours a day.
It's dinner time in Savannah, Georgia. Colleen Hendry is bringing food to her parents' ranch house.
Oops, not warm.
Her mother's watching TV.
Hey, Mama.
Colleen heads to the kitchen to dish out meatloaf, mashed potatoes, green beans, and squash. Her mom suffers brain damage from a stroke. With her dad's health failing as well, Colleen's been helping out more and more in recent years.
Oh, here's your ketchup. And there's your salt shaker.
Edward and Lavinia Fitzgerald settle around the table. It's a normal dinner scene, but for one thing, there's actually an extra guest at this meal.
No, that's Denise. That's our goodest friend.
She's waving at you.
Yeah.
Denise Cady is waving from a computer monitor that sits just next to the kitchen table.
And how's the weather down there?
Couldn't beat it with a stick.
Oh, my goodness.
That's good.
Denise is what's called a tele-caregiver, and for 2 years, she's been checking on the Fitzgeralds every evening from way up in Lafayette, Indiana. She joins in mealtime chatter, just like a friend who's dropped by. She asks after family and neighbors. She takes it in stride when Colleen's mom, Lavinia, gets the sillies, as she often does.
Well, Lavinia, you are really tickled right now.
You might think this isn't so strange. Lots of people use the computer to Skype with far-flung relatives. But it turns out Denise can see almost every move the Fitzgeralds make. Their house is wired with video cameras, like something out of a sci-fi movie, though you can't tell at first.
They have one of the cameras right there.
Oh, I see. It's in like a enclosed bubble in the ceiling.
Yeah, that's it.
I see it turning now.
You can actually hear the camera swivel. There's one in the front that shows who comes in the door. It can pan down a hall to show who goes into the bathroom and bedroom, but it can't see into those rooms. A second camera surveys the living room, dining room, and kitchen. Colleen admits the notion made her wary.
Well, at first I was thinking all sorts of things. My dad sitting around in his underwear, my mother. I just thought, oh my God, these people are going to see everything. You know, and that part of it bothered me.
But after her mom broke her ankle 2 years ago, Colleen became overwhelmed with the duties of caring for her aging parents, and she worried constantly when she wasn't with them.
I know that the burden's on me if something happened.
Desperate for help, Colleen discovered a new video monitoring service and signed them up. It's turned out to be a huge relief for her dad as well. As with many elderly spouses, his wife's condition has thrown Edward into the exhausting role of full-time caregiver. Now, with the cameras on, he can get out of the house for daily mass and a gab session with his buddies at McDonald's.
We go down there and we sit around and talk, and that telephone will ring, and I'm on my way. I'm home in 5 minutes.
Denise or another telecaregiver call Edward's cell phone if they notice Lavinia staying in the bathroom a bit too long. They've called when, in fact, she has fallen and couldn't get up. They also alert Colleen and even call in the middle of the night if something seems wrong.
They're diligent. They're on the ball. And I like it.
What about this high-tech invasion of his privacy? Edward says he never actually worried about it.
That wouldn't bother me. What worried me more than anything else is bringing strangers into your house.
Strangers do come in. A home health aide gets Lavinia bathed and dressed every day. Colleen says she's grateful the cameras can monitor the quality of that care.
Amen, Brother Ben. Mm-hmm. Make a rhyme every time.
That's good. Are those fresh?
The company that's monitoring the Fitzgerald house is called ResCare. Here's the dinner scene from their offices in Indiana.
Amen, Brother Ben.
Oh, looks good. Are those fresh green beans?
Yes, they are.
Telecaregiver Denise Cady sits before two large computer screens. On one, she sees the Fitzgeralds. Cady can also see thumbnail video images of 24 other homes. She'll check on each one over the course of her shift. Clients' children could log into the same video Denise watches and monitor parents themselves. This long-distance care isn't cheap. ResCare services start at $600 a month and can run well over $1,000, depending on how much active monitoring is needed. But that's still a lot less than the average nursing home.
Primarily, the people that are using this at this time are those that are in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's or dementia.
ResCare spokesperson Nell Taylor says a telecaregiver can remind someone to take their medication at a certain time. They can alert a relative if someone appears confused or in distress. They can also help with the simple tasks of daily life, like the time a client was about to sit down to breakfast.
And the telecaregiver zoomed in on the frying pan and said, maybe you ought to cook the sausage and the eggs a little longer. The eggs look kind of runny and the sausage is pink.
No doubt, starring in your own daily reality show won't appeal to everyone. But there are all kinds of remote monitoring systems popping up to keep tabs on a fast-aging population. Most use motion sensors, and they alert children to every mundane detail of a parent's day. When they get in and out of bed, sit on the sofa, open the refrigerator door, turn on the AC. ResCare's Taylor says all the research and startup companies are driven by this simple equation.
At the same time that we have this huge population of aging folks, we have a shrinking population of caregivers, of younger people who are able to provide the care that these older people are going to need. And if we don't find other ways, then we are really going to be in big trouble in the future.
This is for you for later.
Okay.
In Savannah, Colleen scoops out some extra banana pudding for her parents to snack on.
I was going to leave the whole dish, but I thought better of it, Denise.
It would be gone by tomorrow morning, I'm telling you.
Colleen says she figured video monitoring would help her parents stay healthy and at home. She had no idea they would also gain a friend.
You see how old people, they're just lonely. And this makes mom and daddy happy. So I was happy about that aspect. You know, it makes me not so feel so guilty when I run in. Here's your dinner. I'm out of there.
As Denise and the Fitzgeralds keep chatting, Colleen gathers her dishes.
All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
She leaves her parents for the night, reassured that they're not really alone. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
You can see what that video from the Fitzgeralds' house looks like at our website, npr.org. And this evening on All Things Considered, Jennifer reports on houses designed with aging in mind.
And now for a story about things that are selling well and in some cases too well. Last week, an email came out offering a $50 gift card to The Gap for just $25. The response was immediate. 500,000 people clicked buy. That email was legitimate, but it didn't come from The Gap. It came from a company called Groupon. It's one of several companies offering consumers some amazing deals and changing the way businesses market themselves. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
The Gap deal was Groupon's first big national promotion, and the response overwhelmed the company's servers. Rob Solomon is Groupon's president.
We thought it would do well. We had no idea it would do as well as it did, and now we're getting calls from every national retailer out there about how they can get in on the fun with Groupon.
Up until now, Groupon has built its business with a local focus. It partners up with small businesses in the dozens of cities it serves, then offers hard-to-resist savings to the people on its massive email lists. Solomon says the customers buy directly from Groupon.
Traditionally, the cupcake bakery or the Pilates studio or the Brazilian steakhouse wasn't able to sell on the internet, and they maybe promoted themselves a little bit on the internet, but nothing really moved the needle until this thing came along.
And moved the needle it has, sometimes a little too far. Philip Greenspun is the chief helicopter instructor at East Coast Aero Club, a flight school in the Boston area.
They called us at roughly the same time we were thinking maybe something like that would be a good idea.
They put together a deal, $69 for an introductory flight lesson. That's 70% off the regular price.
We priced it so that we wouldn't lose money. That was the hope, you know, if we got everybody to kind of volunteer to come in and teach, or that we would basically recover the cost of running the helicopter for these short intro flights.
Greenspun thought the flight school would sell maybe 200 of these lessons. He says the folks at Groupon told him to expect more like 500. After all, these emails go out to hundreds of thousands of people. But what happened took everyone by surprise.
at 6 a.m., the phone started ringing, and I guess by about 11 a.m., we begged them to cut it off, and that was when about 2,600 had been sold.
Groupon may be the leader in discount group buying on the internet, but it does have competitors. Living Social recently sent an email to its customers in Washington, D.C., offering $50 worth of fancy cupcakes for $25.
Feature is a mango cake with a mango chocolate ganache.
More than 2,000 people responded, double what the managers at the Red Velvet Cupcakery had been expecting. Tracy Wilson says it's been a wild ride for the pastry chefs.
They were literally sleeping in their car outside for a nap and coming back in to start it all over again. They were literally working around the clock.
She says in the first weekend after the deal went out, they made more than 10,000 cupcakes. Tim O'Shaughnessy is the CEO of Living Social. He says online marketing firms like his take a cut on each transaction. The business model is based on two fundamentals. People can't resist a bargain, and small businesses are always looking for more customers.
It is probably a more powerful marketing method than just about anything out there. And, you know, if you work with us, the next day you will start seeing new customers.
For some businesses, there can be a downside. Some complain the response was overwhelming, and they lost existing customers who would have paid full price. Living Social and Groupon say they're working with merchants, but having too many customers is generally a good problem to have. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Some American universities have become quite skilled at turning academic ideas into marketplace successes. The University of Utah is especially good at that, so much so that officials from other colleges trek to Salt Lake City to learn how it's done it. From member station KUER, Jenny Brundine reports.
Back in 1984, Ted Stanley was having coffee. He looked at a bowl of sugar cubes nearby and had an idea. What about putting drugs in the sugar cubes? Now, before you get the wrong idea, Stanley was taking a break from his experiments on how to safely immobilize monkeys. The Utah research professor and doctor specializes in anesthesiology and pain. So, what about putting the drugs in the sugar cubes?
Because monkeys like sugar cubes.
So he did.
And the monkeys loved this.
It was safe and easy.
There was no stress. They didn't yell, you know.
So Stanley starts thinking, what about for his patients? Soon, he and his colleagues had developed the fentanyl lollipop. It quickly alleviates pain in patients with severe cancer. The University of Utah's business school told him he should start a company.
And I didn't know dit squat about any of that. I'm a doctor, you know.
But the school steered him to business people, academic partners, and patent lawyers. And the anesthetic lollipop became a multi-million dollar product, the university's first blockbuster invention. Since then, the school's become a leader in commercializing scientific breakthroughs. So far this year, more than 80 universities have paid a visit to the college to find out its secret. That secret begins with a history of fostering inventions that goes back decades. Take this promotional video from 1984.
The greatest bioengineering effort in the world is at the University of Utah, site of the first permanent artificial heart implant.
The university's entrepreneurial culture drew innovators in medicine, engineering, and later computer graphics. Medicinal chemist Glenn Preswich came here from Stony Brook in New York. He describes the environment this way.
It's a cultural difference, and it's a focus on the entrepreneurial process as a scholarly activity.
He was also struck by the school's collaborative spirit, which he believes leads to more inventions. And there was something else, he says, a deeper focus on the end users of research, the patients and the physicians who treat the patients.
Without that focus, research is just kind of playing. The challenge is getting from the research, the technology, to a product. And that's what the U has become good at.
The U created 20 spin-off companies in 2008 alone, the same as MIT. But MIT has five times the research budget Utah has. Jack Britton is the U's vice president of venture technology development. He says on average it takes $100 million federal research dollars to get a spin-off company.
We were doing one company for every $15 million.
To get there, the university has created an even more sophisticated operation than it had in the 1980s. Then, the business school simply steered professors to contacts. Now, it has a team of entrepreneurial faculty advisors. They're trusted peers, high-level scientists who know a lot about starting companies. Glenn Prestwich is on that team and says asking many academics to turn their idea into a company is like getting a cat to jump into water.
How do you talk to lawyers? How do you talk to potential investors, angel investors? And you have to tell them why your product, your company in the health sciences is worth them putting $500,000 into.
The school can also help inventors secure venture capital. Again, Jack Britton.
Talking to people around the nation, they've kind of had this feeling that capital has dried up in the current recession. We're having just the opposite experience.
In fact, the University of Utah has scooped up more than $270 million in the past 5 years, 90% of it from out of state. Some of that money will be plowed into a special fund for researchers to build prototypes of their inventions, a luxury most colleges don't have. If the idea doesn't work, it's back to the lab. If it does, it's off to the patent office and eventually into the public's hands. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brendine in Salt Lake City.
We're going to hear now from a dramatist who's turned her attention to the basics, the ABCs. Chiara Alegria Hudes has written about the lingering wounds of war in her play Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue. She also wrote the book for the hit Broadway musical In the Heights. That's the tale of one block in New York peopled with immigrants from Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic and set to the rhythms and rhymes of Latin music and hip-hop. Now Chiara Hudes is out with her first tale for kids. It's called Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC, located in the city of her childhood.
I decided to set this book in North Philadelphia, where many of my family live, including my grandma and many young cousins. And the concept was that one girl who's from North Philadelphia, where a lot of Latinos live, is giving a tour, a neighborhood tour, to her best friend who's from Chinatown, and he's come to visit her for the day.
And it's from the point of view of that little girl who is, as you say, introducing her friend to her neighborhood. Let's just start with A.
Okay. So let's see. Here we start with A is for abuela and abandoned car.
And abuela is a grandmother.
That's right. You know, I think one of the defining features for me growing up in my neighborhood was an older generation from Puerto Rico who had an open-door policy in what many considered from the outside to be a dangerous neighborhood. But in fact, this open-door policy is what kept people safe. It was how children were supervised playing outside. And it's how, you know, a hungry neighbor could be fed after work if they didn't have time to go home and cook, if they didn't have money to go and get something from, you know, the corner restaurant.
Now, right off in the A's, there's an abandoned car. It's not too tough, but real clearly this is not an affluent neighborhood.
That's right. My inspiration for writing this book wasn't to talk about how gritty and real the neighborhood was. It was more about the joy of observing. So that we're not just watching TV all the time, we're not just looking at our little tiny screens all the time, but look and see what's around you, observe what's around you. So in this case, that includes, you know, an abuela hugging the grandkids, and it does include an abandoned car, you know, and that has some downsides to it, no doubt, but there's interest and stories in all of those things.
Well, even though when you are illustrating with your words parts of the neighborhood that might not be considered beautiful, the language itself is spare and really quite lovely. Read us the B's.
B is for the bottles that are smashed like falling stars. Broken bottles of black cherry soda bought at Barrio Bodegas. C is for the Chino Latino corner store we call Ortegas.
That's a lovely way of seeing it. It could very well be a child's way of seeing smash bottles on the street glinting. And the illustration there, multicolored.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember I collect marbles. I've collected marbles since I was a kid, and I still collect them, and now my daughter loves them. And I've always just found, you know, different colored glass to be kind of fanciful and playful. And so I remember one of the features of a lot of the sidewalks in Philadelphia is that the broken glass has actually become imprinted into the cement. So the sidewalk can actually take on a mosaic quality. It's a totally chaotic mosaic. But, you know, these are the things I would notice when I was just kind of walking from Abuela's house to the corner store to get her milk or something like that. And I realized today, you know, this is a little nostalgic because everyone has plastic bottles today. So the broken glass might not be as common now as it was when I was a kid.
Why don't you read some more for us? Pick up anywhere you'd like.
I'll start with the ice cream truck because that is where any youthful story should actually start. But A is not for ice cream, so I'll pick up at the letter I. I is for the ice cream truck in infinite flavors so sweet. J is for los jíbaros, jamming in the jungle of concrete. K is for the kitchen window where kidney beans boil and pork chops pop. L is for the living room ledges and little old ladies who guard the block. M is for los muralistas, making murals of island vistas, waterfalls that hide brick walls, rainforests full of tropical trees. N is for the noisy neighbors who sit on the stoop and catch the breeze.
How did you settle on the words to represent the letters of the alphabet? Because some are English and mm-hmm. some are Spanish, like Q, for instance.
Well, Q is for quemar, which is to burn a house to the ground beneath, making a block full of row homes look like a smile that's missing its two front teeth. Q is like X. It's one of those letters that's, you know, notoriously difficult in alphabet books, and, you know, it ends up being queen. You know, there's a handful of three things that it'll end up being, but in Spanish, it's a much more frequently used letter, and it's one of the darker passages in the book, but... You know, the thing about growing up in North Philly and, you know, a house would burn down or a house would kind of fall apart and be dilapidated. And then I had an aunt who led a movement to turn abandoned lots into public gardens. And we get to that part later in the book. So even points that might be a little bit darker in the book end up having a flip side, like a growth, a life to them.
There are a couple of poignant passages here. R mm-hmm. is very touching, especially from a child's eye view.
R is about growing up in a language and in a geography that's very different from the one where your parents grew up. You know, I grew up in cement and brick, and, you know, my parents grew up in the countryside in Puerto Rico, speaking Spanish, and that's all captured in R, and I'll read R right now. R for mommy's favorite word. She always says, remember. Remember that, remember when, remember all the things now gone. Remember red comb rooster singing kikiriki to the dawn. Remember Rincon Beach in Puerto Rico, how the sun would set.
And you would hear that from your own mother or your aunties or something like that?
They always said remember. And in fact, before I made the decision to become a writer, my grandmother was getting along in years and her health was suffering. And my mom said to me, you know, you're the one who's gone to college. You're the one who can write these stories down. So ask her the stories and write them down or they'll be gone.
Playwright Kiara Alegria Hudes has written the children's book Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can see illustrations from the Barrio ABCs, including the ice cream truck of I, at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition for NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
French artist Henri Matisse is probably best known for his decorative and colorful paintings, especially nudes and still lifes. But a current show at the Museum of Modern Art, called Matisse, Radical Invention, focuses on the period in his life from 1913 to 1917, when he was experimenting with different styles. Our critic Lord Schwartz has a review.
In 2003, the Museum of Modern Art put on an important show comparing Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, maybe the two greatest European painters of the 20th century. They were friends and rivals. They influenced and even collected each other's work. The marvelous new show at MoMA, Matisse, Radical Invention, 1913 to 1917, suggests a central way Matisse was very different from Picasso. The Spanish master, practically a synonym for modern art, had an unstoppable sense of direction. He'd pursue one style, a blue period, a rose period, cubism, and when he got to the bottom of it, he'd move on to another. But in the four-year period this Matisse show investigates, the artist's development is much less linear, much less divided into straightforward chapters. Matisse seemed to be trying all sorts of different things at the same time, and he produced some of his greatest paintings. Modern artists were trying to find new ways of looking at the world, moving away from depicting images in traditional three dimensions, and discovering livelier and simpler, yet also more complex ways to convey those images. Even before the central period stressed in this exhibit, we see Matisse experimenting with dimension, a kind of flattening process in which the images become less literal and more symbolic. One of his strangest and most original paintings, Bathers with a Turtle, is from 1908, barely a year after Picasso's tradition-shattering Demoiselle d'Avignon, in which the bodies of five women have been transformed from rounded human beings into fractured and contorted figures with African masks for faces. Matisse's figures are even more mysterious. Three simplified nudes, almost like a child's drawing. He offers no explanation for why they're feeding a turtle, or why one of them has her fingers stuffed into her mouth. Horizontal bands of blue abstractly represent a backdrop of water and sky. It's like Cézanne, but more radical. Modern art is just beginning. Throughout the show, we see Matisse wrestling with the same issues his most celebrated contemporaries were confronting. But Matisse seems to be moving backwards and sideways as well as forward. And through new X-ray technology, the curators have been able to trace Matisse's own processes. We now know when he's deliberately muting his dazzling spectrum of colors or changing the position of his figures. And in many places, instead of hiding some of his changes, he actually allows us to observe them, as if the figures themselves have been moving around the surface of the canvases. The climax of the show includes two of his most extraordinary paintings, both combining an extreme of abstraction with readable, figurative images. Both are huge, but one of them is monumental and hieratic, and the other is achingly poignant. One is the 8x12-foot Bathers by a River from the Art Institute of Chicago, where this show originated. Matisse reworked this painting during this entire period, changing it from a lightweight, pastel-colored beach scene to an exotic Eden, a gigantic icon with four female demigoddesses outlined against a row of broad, flat, vertical panels, with a sinister, or is it benign, white snake rearing up its head from the bottom of the canvas. The other masterpiece is MoMA's own Piano Lesson, an 8-foot-high canvas depicting Matisse's young son at the keyboard, with his mother or piano teacher on a stool keeping shadowy watch. I grew up in New York, and this has been one of my favorite paintings since I was old enough to go to museums. The Piano Lesson, too, has its mysteries in its combination of cool geometry and touching intimacy. The shadow on the boy's face replicates the triangular metronome on the piano, and an even larger green triangle crosses the room. Is it a shaft of unsettling twilight? It's as if time is casting its own shadow over everything, including youth and art itself. These two amazing paintings, within a period of staggering artistic ferment, emerge out of Matisse's complicated search for direction, a search that took many turns before the artist found his direction. Or were these very turns Matisse's true direction?
Lloyd Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed Matisse, Radical Invention, a show at the Museum of Modern Art through October 11th. You can look at all the paintings he mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
The highly charged debate over the proposed Islamic center in Lower Manhattan has attracted the attention of young Muslims who visit Islamic websites and post messages in jihadi chat rooms. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports some experts worry the controversy plays into the hands of extremists.
As originally conceived, the idea behind the Islamic center in downtown Manhattan seemed simple enough.
Well, there will be a 500-seat auditorium, there'll be a swimming pool, there'll be athletic facilities, there'll be cooking classes.
That's Daisy Khan on ABC's This Week. She's the wife of the imam in charge of the proposed center. She envisioned the 13-floor building like a YMCA, except it would be Muslim and would include a small mosque.
Education, forums, conferences, and it's basically become a place where ideas can be exchanged, but tolerance, mutual respect can also be extended.
Instead, what Daisy Khan got was this.
And we will never, ever allow these mosques to be established.
Dueling demonstrations on Sunday outside Park 51, the proposed site for the center.
We don't have a decency of compassion when it comes to respecting those who died.
Hundreds of people showed up. Families of the 9/11 victims called the center an affront to what they considered hallowed ground. Construction workers vowed not to help build it. Civil liberties groups chanted about religious tolerance. And the police did their best to keep the two sides on opposite sides of the street. That's how the debate is playing out publicly. Out in the blogosphere, in password-protected web forums run by extremists, there's a different view. All this controversy is welcomed. Extremists and radical clerics, including one who has become a kind of bug light of sorts attracting young American jihadis, have posted a stream of I told you so messages. They've long claimed that Islam was under attack by the West. The violent reaction to the center, they say, now proves it.
This unfortunately is playing right into their hand, and as such, they are encouraging it with glee.
Evan F. Coleman tracks jihadi websites and chat rooms for Flashpoint Global Partners, a New York-based security firm. He says that extremists couldn't have scripted events any better, and they've made clear that they hope the debate rages on.
It's their sense that by doing this, that Americans are going to alienate American Muslims to the point where even relatively moderate Muslims are going to be pushed into joining extremist movements like Al-Qaeda.
And that worries law enforcement. There have been a record number of homegrown terrorist plots in this country since late last year. Officials say the long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have moved some young Muslims to join the fight. So far this year, the FBI has intercepted nearly a dozen young American Muslims, allegedly on their way to terrorist training camps in Pakistan or Somalia. And in nearly every case, the young men said America's so-called war on Islam was one of their reasons for leaving. And intelligence officials say that every young Muslim they've intercepted this year has claimed to be inspired by one man, an internet cleric named Anwar al-Awlaki.
To the Muslims in America, I have this to say.
Al-Awlaki, the radical cleric linked to the Fort Hood and Christmas Day attacks, made a direct appeal to American Muslims earlier this summer.
How can you have your loyalty to a government that is leading the war against Islam and Muslims?
I am Brian Fishman. I'm a counterterrorism research fellow at the New America Foundation.
Fishman has been tracking al-Awlaki for years, and he says the latest controversy over the Islamic Center has made al-Awlaki look prescient.
Over the past 9 to 12 months, Anwar al-Awlaki has tried to promote this notion that the West, and particularly the United States, will turn on its Muslim citizens. And some of the anti-Islamic tone that has been going on around the country in connection with the mosque debate feeds into this notion that people like Anwar al-Awlaki can take advantage of.
Given the highly charged environment, that notion is unlikely to change anytime soon. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.